Lytton Strachey, as mentioned before, I first got to know through his mother. She and I were fellow members of a committee designed to secure votes for women. After some months, she invited me to dinner. Her husband, Sir Richard Strachey, was a retired Indian official, and the British Raj was very much in the air. My first dinner with the family was a rather upsetting experience. The number of sons and daughters was almost beyond computation, and all the children were, to my unpracticed eyes, exactly alike, except in the somewhat superficial point that some were male and some female. The family were not all assembled when I arrived, but dropped in one by one at intervals of about 20 minutes. One of them, I afterwards discovered, was Lytton. I had to look round the room carefully to make sure that it was a new one that had appeared, and not merely one of the previous ones that had changed his or her place. Towards the end of the evening, I began to doubt my sanity. But kind friends afterwards assured me that things had really been as they seemed. Lady Strachey was a woman of immense vigour, with a great desire that some at least of her children should distinguish themselves. She had an admirable sense of prose, and used to read South's sermons aloud to her children. Not for the matter, she was a free thinker, but to give them a sense of rhythm in the writing of English. Lytton, who was too delicate to be sent to school, was seen by his mother to be brilliant, and was brought up to the career of a writer in an atmosphere of dedication. His writing appeared to me in those days hilariously amusing. I heard him read Eminent Victorians before it was published, and I read it again to myself in prison. It caused me to laugh so loud that the officer came round to my cell, saying, "I must remember that prison is a place of punishment." Lytton was always eccentric, and became gradually more so. When he was growing a beard, he gave out that he had measles, so as not to be seen by his friends until the hairs had reached a respectable length. He dressed very oddly. I knew a farmer's wife who let lodgings, and she told me that Lytton had come to ask her if she could take him in. "At first, sir," she said, "I thought he was a tramp, and then I looked again and saw he was a gentleman, but a very queer one." He talked always in a squeaky voice, which sometimes contrasted ludicrously with the matter of what he was saying. One time, when I was talking with him, he objected first to one thing and then to another as not being what literature should aim at. At last I said, "Well, Lytton, what should it aim at?" And he replied in one word, "Passion." It was odd to hear the word passion pronounced in such a way. Nevertheless, he liked to appear lordly in his attitude towards human affairs. I heard someone maintain in his presence that young people are apt to think about life. He objected. He said, "I can't believe people think about life. There's nothing in it." Perhaps it was this attitude which made him not a great man. His style is unduly rhetorical, and sometimes, in malicious moments, I have thought it not unlike Macaulay's. He was indifferent to historical truth, and would always touch up the picture to make the lights and shades more glaring and the folly or wickedness of famous people more obvious. These are grave charges, but I make them in all seriousness.